A lot of NBA on today's pod. We're just going to get right to it. Kevin Herter, the Atlanta Hawks, on his career and playing with Trae Young. And what's going on with his team? I thought they were going to be better. Also, Jim Peterson, Timberwolves, they are better. 8-3 in their last 11. Anthony Edwards, 40 points last night. So this is going to be fun. And then, of course, a massive life advice that's also basketball related. So look out. It's the Ryan Russillo podcast presented by FanDuel. Take a shot at betting the NBA with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Right now, you can check out the new and improved Parlay Hub. Filter by odds, sport, and bet type to easily find the most popular parlays and same-game parlays all on one page. Plus, start betting the Explore page and the Pulse and bet live same-game parlays for every NBA game. So download the app today and bet with FanDuel, official partner of the NBA. The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit rg-help.com to learn more about the resources and helplines available. And listen to the end of the episode for additional details. Must be 21 and older and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com. This episode is brought to you by Arby's. I remember my first visit to Arby's. I went with my grandfather, fresh out of WWII. I reached for his hand. He declined my grasp. I was worried about the options. I said, I know they dominate the roast beef world, but is there going to be anything for me? And here's the thing. There is. Well, now is the chance to try Arby's and find your favorite sandwich. With a wide range of options, see for yourself that Arby's sells more than roast beef. Plus, for a limited time, Arby's rewards members get one free sandwich with purchase every week in April, online only. Simply join Arby's Rewards and order ahead today. Order on the app or Arby's.com. Our next guest has been my white whale here for, I don't know, a year plus, maybe two. It's Kevin Herter of the Atlanta Hawks. What's up, man?
How you doing? Yeah, we finally got this to work. Thanks for having me on.
You told me it was my schedule. I don't know. We had a couple things lined up. I mean, we had interest early. We were on this very early. I think it might have been the Maryland thing because of my guy Van Pelt. It could have been that. I think there was a realization, too, when I watched you. I don't know if it was Maryland or if it was in the beginning of your pro career where I was like, you know what? This may not be a popular opinion, but I think this guy's a max player. I was kidding about the max part, but it was very clear early on. I'm like, I think this guy's got some stuff. He's got some stuff to his game. So thanks for doing this.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I remember, you know, people were tweeting at me very early in my career saying, I need to get on the podcast and do it. And obviously, you know, the recording times, it's always during our practice time. So that was always the tough part about getting it done. But like I said, glad to be on and finally get to talk.
All right. So what was you go in the first round, you know, you could shoot it. You got some size. I'm sure we understand basketball. There's a buy-in, you know, when people look at you at first and be like, all right, this guy's good. I mean, you're probably dealing with that your whole life. Did that happen in the NBA too?
Yeah. I mean, I think I come across unassuming to everybody. I think it's one of those things that, you know, even when coming out of college, my draft stock wasn't too high. I had to go to the combine and really play well there for me to get into the first round. And ever since I got in the NBA, I feel like it's kind of been much of the same, just consistently having to prove myself. You know, even so today, finally, you know, this summer I was able to get the second contract done. And, you know, we still have a lot to prove, both individually and as a team, that I kind of like it. You fly under the radar a lot. You're unassuming. You're not always the first guy in the scouting report, but hopefully by game's end, the other team can feel your presence.
Was there a moment for you where, you know, everybody's different with this. So it's either supreme confidence is sometimes misplaced, too much doubt, you know, realization. Was there ever like a little doubt, hey, am I good enough to then in the moment, did you have that kind of epiphany in your rookie year where you're like, oh, wait, like I got this?
Yeah, I mean, my rookie year definitely did not start off great. You know, I was coming off of college. I had hand surgery in the summer going into my rookie year, and feel like I wasn't able to get better going from college to the NBA. And that summer is really important, just working on your game and getting ready for the NBA game, and missed all the training camp. And so my first NBA action, I was just kind of thrown in the fire in the preseason. It didn't play that well. Obviously, wasn't comfortable. And, you know, the first couple of games didn't get a lot of playing time, and was definitely struggling a little bit. And, you know, they talked about I'd be sent down to the G League for a little bit, just trying to work and catch my rhythm, catch the speed of the NBA. And, you know, a lot of the NBA, it's always about opportunity. And, you know, that year, a couple guys who were ahead of me got hurt that the Hawks really didn't have a choice at that time. They had to play me. I was one of the few guys on the roster that was healthy at my position. And You know, once you play a couple games, you find your confidence, you find your rhythm, you adjust to the speed of the game. You know, really a quarter of the way through my rookie year, I feel like I started to finally catch my rhythm. And yeah, I think it was a game we were playing in Philly, ironically, my rookie year. I ended up, you know, having well into 20, and you know, at the end of the game was had the ball in my hands. I was making plays, and John Collins ended up hitting a game winner. We won that game on the road in Philly. And I think that was, when you say like found your confidence where I knew I belonged, I think it was, that was really the start of it, where, you know, I knew that I was a player that belonged in this league and it could compete at a high level and play against really good players every night.
What was it like to get 27 in game 7 against the Sixers?
I mean, it was one of those things. It was like, I was so in the moment that it didn't hit me, or I didn't think about it really till after the game, or even a couple months after the game. And even more so now that, you know, the Sixers are about to blow it up in some ways. It was just one of those things. Like, I knew I was hot. Like, the first couple shots I took in that game were mid-range pull-ups, and those were all just rhythm shots, and they all went down for me. And, you know, I hit a three at the end of the half, and it was one of those things, like, all right, I got it going. And you'll play that whole game. And the worst thing you could do is have a good game and something like that and you lose. So it really was like, the only thing in my mind was like, we got to figure out a way to win this game, because you know, anything that I do wouldn't matter. People won't remember it. And you'll continue to kind of hit shots that whole game, had a matchup I liked, and we come out with a W. And it was really after that, you know, we won in the next series and nobody talked about it too much, but it was, but after the dust had settled, we finished the season and a couple weeks went by that was, like, you look back and, you know, I went back home and people are talking about it, like how crazy it was to watch that game. And for me, obviously, it's a game I'll never forget.
This is kind of I'll give you kind of a timeline of observation. Like, you came in with Trey. Trey had that summer league where everybody's making fun of him, being like, this is the worst pick of all time. All right. So I get Trey's attitude of like, screw everybody, because now he's turned himself into what's a perennial all-star. But prior to Nate taking over, I was like, whatever, they're just losing a million games again. You know, I wasn't. You're not going to tell me the truth. You may completely disagree. I thought that Trey in the beginning of his career was a little tougher to play with despite his talent, because I felt like he had every position on his own. You can nod silently or not. I'm just kidding. I don't want to get you into trouble or anything like that. That Sixers series changed everything for me, because Trey was the toughest dude on the court out of both teams. And we can get into this year being disappointed, because we'll get to that. But that was a real pivot for me, where I was like, oh, man, I'm like, this dude doesn't give a shit. He's not afraid of anybody out there. What was that like for you to experience?
Yeah, I mean, you know, just like any player, you know, Trey went through growth to start his career, just like anybody else does. And he's such an elite talent that his whole life, it's, you know, he's had the ball in his hands and he's making plays and everybody's just kind of playing off him, because he's the best player on the court and you wanted the ball in his hands. And so yeah, to start his career, there's definitely some growing pains. There's growing pains for everybody. And you know, once we caught a rhythm last year, and it started a little bit before the playoffs. Once we caught a rhythm, I think he started to trust the guys around him, and the guys around him started playing better and making shots and you know, proving themselves that, you know, you can make big plays in big moments. We got in the playoffs and he had a big, just like, F you to everybody. And I feel like everybody followed that. And it did. It started in that New York series, just like, he was hated the second we started that series. And his whole life, you know, everyone telling him he's too small or too this, and comparing him to Luka. There's always these comparisons that follow him. I think he had a lot to prove in that first playoff run, that he could win and that he could win at a high level in this league. And that's not something that changes. You know, he's someone, he has it tattooed on him that it's, he never forgets. And he's somebody that always, he plays with a chip on his shoulder. And I feel like, you know, last year, the energy that he brought and kind of the attitude he brought to every game was something that our team definitely followed.
Coming into this year, I was so excited about the depth, because I think you can throw shooters at people. You can throw size at guys. You know, DeAndre not being healthy hurts because of some of the wing defensive, you know, problems, I think, that you probably would admit to. Before we get into kind of what this has meant for this year, give me a scouting report. Like, what's your role on the team? What's Trey like? You know, who's the guy you're closest with? Because there's a lot of guys that are all looking for minutes. So sometimes I worry about, does everybody get along, or, you know, is everybody kind of still so young and new to this that it's still a fun experience, even if this year hasn't been at the point that you probably expect it to be?
Yeah, I mean, I really see my role is kind of a do it all kind of role. And that could change game by game, you know, whether I'm starting, whether I'm not starting. I've always seen myself as a player who elevates the game of everybody else on the court. And that's whether, you know, offensively finding guys' shots, you know, being a ball mover, defensively, you know, who I'm guarding, being able to guard multiple positions, you know, being able to switch with bigs. And then obviously at times being more aggressive, looking for my own shot, trying to score, but that's not always the case game by game. Like you said, our team, we have so many weapons. We're not healthy a lot. We're finally healthy right now. And it's great to have all these weapons on the court. You talked about having DeAndre Hunter back and his defensive presence. So I think he's one of the underrated. He's one of the best defenders in the league and that people don't really know about yet. Just, you know, he's been caught by a couple of bad luck, had some injuries, but we can keep him on the court. It feels like he scored 20 every game for us. He's guarding other teams' best players. Trey goes and he gets 30 most nights. And, you know, having John and Clint kind of clean up the middle and Bogey and myself being shooters and Gallo being a shooter. Yeah, you know, we definitely feel like we have a lot of weapons and we have a lot of different options. We can win games in a variety of ways. And, you know, offensively, we can really be elite. And for us, everything is, it's going to be figuring out the defensive end. Having someone like DeAndre back has been huge. And everybody just buying in a little bit more, you know, showing a little bit more effort and urgency. I don't think, you know, maybe our urgency to start the year was where it should be. And I think it's picking up as of late. But I wouldn't want to do the scouting report against our team. So I'll leave it at that. It's, you know, I think we have a lot of people you got to worry about. And, you know, if we're all clicking at the right time, I think we can beat anybody.
Yeah, I thought it was weird when I'd heard like, yeah, we're a little bored going into the year. And you're like, no, you're a young team. You're supposed to be like going into this fired up. You know, like it was great you made it to the Eastern Conference Finals last year. Congrats on the series against Philly. But no, now it's time to turn it on. And yeah, the defensive numbers, you already know this. They've been terrible. Do you collectively, I know the answer is, of course, we believe in ourselves. But do you collectively believe that you should be back towards the top three or four teams in the East?
We do. I mean, you know, within the past week, we've beaten a lot of the top teams that are in the East. And we feel like we're right there. And like I said, we feel like if we're healthy and guys are clicking that we can beat anybody. That's both in the East, that's in the West. We just have to prove it. And you know, we definitely dug ourselves a hole to start the year and won 7 or 8 straight and dug ourselves a hole again. And you know, we got hit by COVID pretty hard and had guys in and out of the lineup and now we're trying to climb ourselves out again. But you know, in a lot of ways, we feel like we can get to 500. You know, we're right back in the mix in the Eastern Conference. We're right back in a 7 or 8 if we're 500. And you get hot again, you can get up into that 5 or 6. And, you know, from there, it's anybody's ballgame. So we got a lot to do still. You know, I think to start the year, I don't like boring. I don't know if his, because I remember Trey said that. He said that in a quote. And I'm not sure.
It's a bad quote. It was a bad quote.
Right. You know. I'm not sure it's exactly what he meant. It was definitely like the urgency. You go from playing in those games and the energy that's in the building, and it was our first time, and then you go to game one and it's, and you're looking at the seed and you're like, we got 82 of these before we get back to where we just were 2 months ago. And so I think that was staring at us in the face a little bit. And being a young team, you know, the first time again that we're going through it, we're, hey, we got to start the year and the regular season matters. You got to position yourselves in the playoffs to get there. And some we didn't handle well, obviously, and you know, now we're have to deal with it.
All right, how did the Kayvon thing start?
It's funny. It was old teammates. It was DeAndre Hunter, Taurean Prince. It was back in like my second year, and it was an alter ego. It was like every game that I played well or scored a lot, they'd come in, and I was like, "Damn, you were Kayvon yesterday." And I'm sure a lot of it has to do with the culture of Atlanta and you know, the people that follow our games and our fans. And it was something that kind of stuck on. And once it got out, everybody loved it. So basically, if I score 20 or more in a game, I'm Kayvon, and if I don't, then I'm Kevin. And you know, if I'm scoring 5 or below or 10 or below or something like that, and it's an ugly game, they call me Kelvin. So it's there's 3 different types of alter egos.
Who gives you the most shit then on the team? Who's your buddy, or is it hopefully it's your buddy, yeah. Someone you get along with? I don't know.
Yeah, me and John bust on each other a lot. You know, he was someone I came in and he wasn't obviously a rookie with us, but he was never someone that was trying to make any of the rookies do stuff. And we connected right away. Been through a lot of games together, a lot of losses, a lot of wins. But you know, I would say we bust on each other a lot. Same with D Hunt. But our team as a whole, you know, our locker room is close, and it has to be.
If there's a tournament of one-on-one amongst you guys, who wins?
Tournament of one-on-one.
Yeah.
Trey's a good one-on-one player, just defensively. you know, I think that would definitely be, you know, he'd have to, if he got ball first, I think it'd be tough. But D Hunt's a good one-on-one player. He's got a shot that it's tough to block. He kind of shoots it behind his head, so he can really get off any shot he wants. And defensively, he's obviously tough to score on. But I'm saying the sleeper is Danilo Gallinari. That guy, like, one-on-one is almost unstoppable. When I was out for COVID, he was out for COVID at the same time. And the last couple of days when we were both clear symptom-wise and we were set to come back, you know, our build-up, we were playing one-on-one against each other. And there's some times, man, this guy hits some tough shots. And if you're someone who knows him or has seen him throughout his career, he's someone that he hits a lot of shots that you think shouldn't be going in, or you're questioning how he got it off, and he makes it. But Gallo's definitely, he's a sneaky one-on-one player.
I'll watch him some nights and I go, is he even moving out there tonight? Like, what's going on? And then he just, like, kind of finds his spot and he doesn't have to dribble much. And sometimes it's also wild. I'll be like, what's he doing tonight? And then some nights it's just on.
He gets the easiest 20 points I've seen in my career so far, my short career. I remember like playing against him when he was on the Thunder. And it was like, you really didn't notice it. And you look up at the end of the game and he's got 18 to 20. And then he gets on our team. And for the most part, we've been bringing him off the bench. And he goes in, he plays 18 minutes. Like you said, it doesn't look like he bends his knees one time. And you look up and he's got 20. He's just kind of that kind of player.
What's it like for you in Atlanta? You know, this is a team that's definitely like it. It feels like it's so embraced when things like Atlanta can be. And Atlanta's had a nice run between Georgia and the Braves here. I realize that Georgia is not exactly downtown Atlanta. But what's it like for you? You know, year four coming out of Maryland, being a pro NBA player and walking around and being part of the community.
I really enjoy it. I really like the city. I'm from upstate New York. I'm not from a big city. I'm not from anywhere that's near a big city. The closest, obviously, being New York. That's a little over 2.5 hours away. And for me, I think I enjoy being in a city that's lively. You know, it feels like all the teams when I first got here were right at the start of their rebuild. And that's us. That's the Braves. I think the Falcons were really good when I first got here and kind of went into a mini rebuild here in the last couple of years. And the soccer team has been good, but you know, it's a city that I feel like truly has embraced all the young guys on each roster, and you know, they root for you and they're excited about what the future holds. And so from the second I got here, it's been a lot of love, and you know, people obviously rooting for us, and it's a fun city to be a part of. Obviously really good sports teams. The weather's great. You know, I live pretty much in the city, and so I walk around a lot. There's great food. So far, I love it. You know, obviously, you win more, everything's a lot better. So the run we made last year definitely helped a lot.
Do you have your talk shit moment? Do you talk shit to anybody
after they? I'm not a big shit talker. I never really have been.
What about to you? There had to have been somebody early that was just like.
There was a couple. Obviously, you know, that's really every year. I think, you know, one that was funny, and you know, we're both represented by the same agent, so we talked to each other, was, you know, me and Bradley Beal a couple of years ago. We both got double text in one game, but after the game, it was one of those things like we're laughing, talking about it.
What did you say to each other? Do you remember?
I think he scored on me. He had an and one, and I was guarding him all game, and he knows I was doing well on him too, but I was guarding him, so he had an and one and just like held the ball out and gave it to me. And so I like shoved the ball away, like said something, and both got texts, but he was at the free throw line just kind of laughing. And it was, in some ways, I felt like he knew that like I was the young guy. Like, you know, our agent told him at some point, like, hey, look out for our guy Kev, he's on the Hawks. And, you know, Brad is someone I obviously respect his game tremendously. He's one of the best scorers in this league. So if you go out there and you can hold him to not 30, I feel like you did a good job.
I'd like to know who started this is a little different, but who started the, no matter what, never give the ball back to the ref. Like, make sure you walk away 10, 20 feet and then drop it behind you instead of just turning and being like, here, I know you have to check it. This is a new thing. It's not new, but it's league-wide now. Every guy decides, I'm just going to be a pain in the ass after this call and then put the ball over here. Who started that? Do you ever do it?
I mean, it's being petty for sure. And there's so many rules about what you can say to a ref, what you can't say to a ref, how you're supposed to treat a ref, and you know, being respectful towards them, and they'll be respectful back. And a lot of times, it's not the case. And so, I think in some ways, you know, holding the ball after a play and walking away with it, technically you're not breaking any rules, but the ref, he knows what you're doing and he knows how you're doing it. And you're just kind of trying to be difficult for a sec. And I think it's something that I'm not sure who started it, but it's something that everyone's picked up on, just as kind of like a mini FU, like, hey, I didn't agree with that call you just had.
It's out of control right now. Dwight loves doing it too, but Dwight doesn't get the ball that often. So that's why he wants to hang on to it the entire time.
True. Certain guys get away with it over others.
Yeah, you get that too. Because when I watch you, I would never call you a complainer. You're definitely not a complainer. But you probably have moments where you feel like I gotta say something, even though I think league wide complaining is way too much. I don't know if you feel differently about that one. I just feel like, okay, we get every call, every single call here now. But when is it for you? When do you know, okay, this is the decision where I feel like I need an audience for the way things are going?
Yeah, I think it's obviously it depends on who I'm guarding, or it depends on who's guarding. You got to realize that superstars get more calls than the rest of the crew, as much as nobody wants to admit it. Everyone knows it's true.
It's totally true.
You want refs to trust you. So in a lot of ways you can't, or at least I try not to. I try not to argue when I know I fouled somebody. If I fouled somebody, I'll keep my mouth shut. I'll kind of give them a nod like, yeah, I fouled him. So then the next time that I go up to him and I'm emotional about something, or I'm pissed off and I don't think I fouled him, that they actually believe me. And the best thing you do, and this is like something that I do, is kind of, because I want the ref to also know he's wrong. So I want to tell him on the court. And a lot of times they don't agree. And you know, that's why they called it differently than what I think. And so if it's the first half, I always go in, I'm like, go back, look at that play at halftime and tell me if I'm right. And so right away, it's like, we have to have another conversation at halftime. And most of the time it's somebody telling me like, yeah, I might've missed that, or no, you didn't. And then we have another talk at halftime. And so it's a subtle way of keeping the conversation going, or if I'm going up in the middle of the game and I'm telling somebody I didn't foul somebody, or I'm trying to look up at the scoreboard, refs don't want to look up at the big screen during the game. But if you tell them like, hey, go back at halftime and tell me I'm wrong, usually they'll go in, they'll rewatch the play, and sometimes they'll come out and be like, yo, Kev, I missed that. And you expect a makeup call in the second half.
See, I like that though. I think that's smart. It's tactical. It's like, I got to make sure I use my spots where, let me be delicate about this. I can't stand watching Kyle Lowry play, but I respect what he brings to a team. Right. I respect what he is. I also have some weird respect that he believes he's right that often about some of the calls. Like, I'll look at him and go, this is actually amazing that you could believe you're right.
Right. Well, there's so many guys like that where it's guys who have been in the league a long time, have a lot of respect within coaches, within refs, and you're on the court and it's, they blatantly hack somebody, or there's a call that they're arguing and they're following the ref to the scorer's table and they're remote, and you're kind of sitting there like, man, you fouled them. Like, well, why are we sitting here? Why are we arguing about this? And Kyle's someone that, again, when you're guarding him, he's so good at drawing fouls that you got to be extra careful when you're guarding him. And he definitely gets more calls than I guess a rookie would get, just because he knows the NBA rules. He knows how to manipulate the rules. And Kyle's unbelievable, obviously, for what he's doing to the Heat. But there's so many guys like that that it really doesn't matter what the play is. It's almost like they're arguing just to argue, just to start talking to the refs, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, even Harden the other day just came out and said he's mad about the inconsistency of the calls that he's getting. And I'm like, dude, you're back to third in free throw attempts per game right now in the NBA. So, but that's just the way everybody's wired. All right, so this is good, because I asked your GM, Travis, about this. I said, do you ever have moments when Trey drives and then he projectiles himself backwards into a guy and gets the call where you laugh with guilt and you laugh with guilt? And Travis was funny about the answer. He's like, well, there's, and so that was the big thing coming into this year. They were going to stop doing it. Cause I hate it. I hate it so much. What's the maddest you've seen an opponent get at Trey getting one of those calls? Because I've seen some, cause I watch you guys a lot. I really like a lot of the depth this team has, and you, of course, but sometimes I see guys where I'm like, I can't believe they're not going to either go in the tunnel at half or retire.
It really is. It's like every single game that he gets, whoever is guarding him, he gets somebody like so pissed off and going to the refs. And yeah, I honestly can't imagine how frustrating it is to have to guard Trey in a game. Yeah, he's, it's like every little thing, you know, if you're touching him, he knows how to draw a hand where he's swiping his hands through and he's getting a call. If you're trailing him on a screen, he knows how to stop and throw his body where he just, you know, he stops his momentum. Guys carry themselves into him. He hits him and he draws a foul. Going to the rim, if you're trying to get physical with him, he's light enough that, you know, he can fall off and draw fouls. But every other moment of the game, he's bumping into guys. You know, he knows how to manipulate calls. If you give him space, he's hitting threes. And everybody, you go into every game and you know that Trey is 1A, 1B, 1C on everybody's scouting report. And it's how can we stop this guy? And to go in and, you know, all these big athletes, the big long threes of the NBA and the big forwards, and you're going in and you're like, you're guarding Trey. And you walk out and you look at him, you're like, this is the guy who's averaging 30 a night. And he goes into games. I think the funniest part is, you know, when he does that thing where he stops and he kind of just, and he goes into a shot. You know, there's times he splits guys' lips. You know, where
okay.
The back of his head is hitting guys and they're getting a little blood on their lips and they're going to the ref like, how are you calling that on me? And Trey's at the free throw line just shooting free throws. And I think for me, that's where I think visibly I'll be on the court just kind of laughing. Like, I would be so like frustrated guarding this guy in a game. There, you can't really touch him. Like, he's so good at drawing fouls and manipulating him that you can't get physical with him. And then, you know, he'll do it right back.
All right, you're being very diplomatic about this idea that he just stops and then people run into him. When he doesn't do it as much because he knew he wasn't getting away with it as much this year. When he jumps backwards into somebody, okay, he jumps backwards. When he split Tim Hardaway Jr.'s chin in the it was like the very, very beginning of the season, and Hardaway got called with a foul, Trey's still mad. By the way, nobody gets madder before the call he's about to get than Trey Young. Like, he's about to get the call and he's already turned and he's incensed. And the ref's like, my arm is already up. Like, what's the issue? And Hardaway's going, my chin is bleeding. Like, what are you talking about? Yeah. I do think he stopped going backwards as much because they were on the lookout for it this season. But I think, again, between some of the top free throw guys, I think the league is kind of, you know, it's gone kind of back to not entirely what it was, but I don't think that was going to be a league long thing or a year long thing. It certainly isn't.
No. And it's like I said, it's, you know, Tim, he's on a short list of guys that that's happened to. He's not the only guy that he's gotten his lip split, but it's, you know, every team, they go into every game and they try to be physical with him. And it feels like no matter what teams are doing, he knows a way to draw foul of how teams are being physical. You're going to try to bottom me up, I can fall. You're going to bottom me up, I'm just going to stop when I'm going to a shot. And you're trying to get handsy, I can swipe through and draw a foul. He's so good at manipulating fouls that it's got to be frustrating. And Tim Hardaway, he's, like I said, he caught it, I think, the first game of the year, like you're talking about, and literally walking away off the court with a bloody lip, and Trey's at the free throw line, and like, he's the one who drew the foul.
I remember Nash in a game. I don't want to spend any more time on this, but Nash was just incensed one game last season where he's like, this just isn't basketball. Like, what? It's like, this isn't basketball. He was freaking out about it.
That was someone too. So, I mean, Trey's learned a lot of his game from Steve. So that was kind of something that when he said it, I was like, hey, he's watching film of you and how you're drawing fouls and, you know, how you used to play. So I think it's different now. He has to coach against them, but if Steve wasn't an enemy of the refs, he was someone that was out there and, you know, he was drawing fouls and, you know, knew how to manipulate the game just like everybody else today.
I feel like I've made the interview about this too much, so I want to finish up here shortly. And just so anybody knows, as a media voter now, I voted for Trey to be a starter, despite my annoyance at times with all of this. So you're good. You guys think. Because at the beginning of the year, I was like, look at all of these guys. Look at all these options. Even Okongwu, when he comes in, and I'm like, the rotation of bigs for them. And I know, you know, you moved on from Cam because there probably just wasn't enough room, even though he had shown glimpses. I think defensively, maybe there's some issues there too. Like, what's going to happen with this team this year? Because there's some hopes for him.
It's a great question. We've won four in a row as of right now, and they have another game Wednesday, but we feel like we're definitely playing better, but, you know, we have a lot of ground to make up. You know, we're four games under 500, and you know, you lose a game, now you're five games. It's, you know, really every single game for us matters. And, you know, the way the injury bug has bit our team in the past, and, you know, luckily I think we've got through COVID, but we really can't get too comfortable. We feel like if we're on the court, we have the talent to win a lot of games in a row and beat really anybody, but we're still in a hole here that we have to dig ourselves out of. So we get to 500, we can get into a game. You know, I think we have really good players at every position and really good players that back up every position that we can be a team that can make another deep run. We just have to get there first.
Well, I hope it happens for you, because I actually started to really enjoy you guys. And I don't know if you can answer this. I was going to ask for Bill Simmons, hey, why are they so easy to predict offensively at the end of close games? But I don't think you probably couldn't answer that for us, could you?
Probably, yeah, probably couldn't. I haven't seen as many of their end of games as you guys have at the same time.
All right. We'll work on that one for you next time. Although I'd get you in all sorts of trouble if you ever answered that. I actually don't think it's that complicated of an answer. Hey, man, good luck the second half of the season. Looking forward to it. It's been a lot of fun seeing you now in your 4 years and getting the contract and the whole deal. As a kid that I remember Van Pelt just being like, dude, this Herter guy's pretty good. I was like, yeah, no, he is good. I know this isn't the biggest goal, the ultimate goal, but it's been a lot of things checked off the list here so far for you, Kevin. So thanks again.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate having me on. Hopefully we can do this again, not in 2 years.
Yeah. Now that we've made the connection, it'd be easy to close this one in. Thanks again. This episode is supported by State Farm. So look, a little rock hit your dude's windshield on the highway. And at first you're like, what is that? I'm like, oh, it's just a little mark. Nope. Now by the end of the ride, it's a big crack. And it had been a while. So I check out the State Farm app. I go, hey, this is what happened. And the funny thing is I was like, do I want to go app first or do I call? Old school guy, probably should call. I was like, let's check out the app. Not only did it take a minute to get done, they set up the glass replacement. They told me the estimate ahead of time, said, you want to go ahead with it? And I was like, now I understand. It's all in front of me, all done. I don't even have to talk to anybody. That's how efficient the insurance game has become. But really, the only words you need to remember are, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. State Farm has options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, just like I did, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to somebody. The app was so good, I didn't even need to do that. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Learn more at statefarm.com. This episode is brought to you by Hulu Plus Live TV. Looking for a better way to watch live TV? Stream your favorite sports and shows on over 95 live channels with Hulu Plus Live TV. Get access to Hulu's entire streaming library, Disney Plus and ESPN Plus, all in one plan. Start your free trial of Hulu Plus Live TV today. Live TV plan required. Restrictions apply. Access content from each service separately. Learn more at Hulu.com. If you're a league pass guy like I am, he's easily in the top five. He might even be a little bit higher for me, but Jim Peterson was the analyst for the Minnesota Timberwolves. He's been on TV since 2003. He's been with radio since 98, and he joins us now to talk some Timberwolves and maybe a little story time as well. What's up, man? I'm glad we finally got to do this. I've been a huge fan for such a long time. You are terrific on the broadcast.
Likewise. You know, you and Van Pelt, I mean, I go back a long ways with you guys too, and I've been a big fan. And we've been trying to do this for a while. I just was telling you before we came on camera that, you know, it's been a rough 17 years, Ryan. ever since, the Western Conference Finals with Cassell, Sprewell, and Garnett, it's been one thing after another. And I feel like we finally are on solid footing. I think one of the mantras for me is in Finch we trust. And I think Chris Finch is showing he's got the coaching chops.
He absolutely does. I could start there because I remember last season why I had some glimmer of hope. Obviously, with a ceiling on the level of hope that I had for the Timberwolves this year, was that I just felt like there was an attitude adjustment with this team that I saw at the end of the regular season, where I was watching them fight and having stretches where I go, this team is different. Their mentality seems to be a little bit different. And I understand the Finch thing nationally wasn't a popular transition because it was a little non-traditional, but I had multiple teams or multiple people from different teams around the league going, hey, whatever anybody's saying about Finch, they don't even know anything about this guy because he is outstanding. So what has the head coach done to kind of change some of this?
Well, I mean, it goes like you were talking about how sort of against the grain his hiring was. I mean, the Wolves are in New York, and Gerson Rosas decides to let Ryan Saunders go, and Coach Finch is hired immediately. And there was no process. And that's one of the things that Rick Carlisle kind of had a problem with, you know, is, you know, ever since the George Floyd thing, you know, it's been, you know, a lot of scrutiny, need be more black head coaches in this league. And so, you know, when you don't go through a process, I mean, there's some eyebrows that are raised, but Ryan, when Chris Finch came in kind of under this firestorm, he was so calm, cool, and collected. He just was in control, you know, and in a great way. And, you know, one of the things I always say is I kind of compare a lot of executives and coaches and NBA people to Kevin McHale, because McHale is one of the greatest people in our organization. I've known Kevin McHale since I was in high school. So that's 1980. Kevin recruited me to go to Minnesota when I was in high school, and him and Flip Saunders both. And McHale just has a great way about him of, like, as great a player as he was, he's just like every man, you know? And he's got a great sense of humor, great storyteller. And McHale was just the best to be around, talking the game, being funny. And so Mac would tell me about Chris Finch. When Mac was in Houston, J.D. Bickerstaff and Chris Finch were both on McHale's staff. And Kevin would tell me what a great personality was. And all the people in the Rockets organization would say, this Chris Finch guy is unbelievable. And I had never really even heard him speak up until the time we met him in a Zoom when he was hired. And when he's hired, he comes in and he's just in control. He's calm, cool, collected, funny, connects with the guys right away. And, you know, it was during COVID. We weren't traveling with the team last year. So we were kind of like, you know, at arm's distance. I didn't really meet Chris Finch until this past summer, and where I was around him. And so, you know, all of his post-game press conferences, he was so insightful. He's a wordsmith. He likes the English language. And so the way that he phrases things is just so good. And then the way he connects with players. And so this year when training camp started, you know, we're now able to be in the building and we're watching training camp. And I'm now able to see Chris Finch in his element coaching. And he does a great job deferring too. He lets Mike and Nori coach. He lets all the other assistants kind of have their thing. He's not controlling everything. But then when he's speaking and when he's teaching, it's, you know how when you see somebody speak, they're just on another level and the level of communication. And he's so cool because he's telling them why he wants things done. And then when they're out there messing up, he will hit the boiling point and he will go off, but in a controlled way that is just super succinct. And so I just can't say enough about how he's coming and sort of taken over the organization and been so calm, cool, and collected, and so smart. And the way that he's changed the defensive concepts. I mean, the Wolves were one of the worst defensive teams in the league, you know, over the past 7 to 10 years. And, you know, Rick Adelman had a couple of years where it was pretty good, but Finch has come in and he really has changed how Minnesota's done things. So I can't say enough about what a good person he is, how funny he is, how he connects with people, and how inclusive he is. It's been great.
There has been a long time for Timberwolves fans, you know, wondering, you know, I used to always talk about, like, when you're tanking or when you're just losing, you know, you hope to be in place with assets to have hope, right? And that was what Towns was, and that's what Wiggins was. The Wiggins part of it doesn't work out. You take on the Russell trade, and you're worried about... And Levine too, right? Yeah, but I mean, look, the Jimmy Butler thing. I think all of us understood the packaging of that, you know, for Jimmy. Although I was watching you the other night when he was out for rest in one of those games a few years ago when you were losing your mind on the intro. What was the Jimmy Butler era like for you?
Well, see, here's the thing. You know, I think that when Flip was when Flip Saunders put that team together, when he got Wiggins and Zach LaVine, and then Towns came after that. And now you've got this young nucleus, and I think everybody was kind of like, you know, envious of that. When you know, Flip tragically passed away and Sam Mitchell took over, Sam did a great job, actually, with those young guys. He really connected with them. And then, you know, Mr. Taylor decided to bring in Tom Thibodeau. And Tibbs that first year, you know, he goes 31-51, but during that season, Zach LaVine tears his ACL. And it was in Detroit. It was just, it's one of those things, it was kind of a nothing play. And when Zach tore his ACL, it kind of forces Tibbs' hands, because now, you know, when you go 31-51 and you're brought in to get the team to the playoffs, Tibbs is going to do what he needs to do. And so when you're president of basketball operations and the coach, you know, I mean, you're willing to make some choices. And so I think, you know, when you trade Zach LaVine away, it's like, of those three, Sam Mitchell and I would talk about this. Wiggins was probably one that was the most talented, just in raw talent. Towns was probably the most skilled, but Zach LaVine was the one that, boy, the way he was wired up, Ryan, like, and you can see what he's doing now in Chicago. The kid just loved the game, and he was so athletically gifted, and it on a level that is very rare. And you have to agree that Zach LaVine is, just from a physical standpoint, he was a freak of nature. So of the three, I Towns and Zach were the ones that I personally would have kept. And so when Tibbs shipped him out, I was a little bit disappointed, just because I knew what he was, and I think we kind of all knew what he was. But when you get Jimmy Butler back in that deal, I get it. Look, I get it. But I the plan of trying to get and keep Jimmy long term just wasn't there.
So then you're kind of in this pattern of like, all right, the Jimmy thing doesn't work out. You lose the asset in LaVine, and on top of some of the other pieces involved in that trade, which would have been marketing, but, you know, whatever. And then Anthony Edwards comes along. And I wasn't sure out of Georgia, other than physically, how special he was. It's funny because we had some guys at the top of that draft in general just like, can any of them shoot? And then Anthony Edwards, this thing happened, at least for me this year with him, where beginning of the year, I'm like, I am all in on this guy. And it's not just the numbers. It's not just the dunks. It's that there is something. Even last night, there was a moment last night in the Portland game. He goes for 40. And this is the stuff I noticed with him. He was back as Portland was taking free throws. And I think you only had two on the free throw rebound. And he sees it and he turns to one of the teammates and yells to be like, whoa, what are you doing? Like, get up there. And I went, I love this guy. So what is he? Because he seems to just be like, it's not, a lot of guys get numbers, but this feels like the kind of talent and kind of personality you can actually kind of, you know, think long term about what your team is capable of.
He's a killer. You know, he's a killer. He is. He thinks he can win any matchup. He thinks he can. No moment is too big for him. He's super confident. He wants to be great. He's coachable. He's like all the things you want a player to be from an intangible standpoint. That's what he is. He's, you know, he was plug and play, like, from a media standpoint. I mean, like, the guy would come in and win the press conference every single time. He had people cracking up, which shows you a level of intelligence. You know what I mean? Like he's a high functioning kid. Like, he's really smart, and he comes in and wins the press conference and has people cracking up, and he just tells the truth, and he's so raw. But then on the court, I mean, you've seen it for yourself. I mean, you've watched a lot of Anthony Edwards, so you know how no moment's too big for him. He's very confident. He's learned a lot on the defensive end. He was not good last year as a rookie. Didn't have a lot of awareness, but he wants to be good. And then there have been players that have come and mentored him. Ricky Rubio last year, and then Patrick Beverley this year. Patrick Beverley's been, I don't know, nationally, if people understand, like, how important Pat Bev has been to the culture and fabric of this team. But he's made everybody committed to the defensive end. And it's not just Pat Bev. It's also the way that Pat Bev has transformed D'Angelo Russell and the way that he's communicated. Like if you watched the game last night, Ryan, you saw – Anthony Edwards go over to the bench and Pat Bev, like, in his ear, like, telling him, talking to him. And so that's the way Pat Bev has been with him. It's been great the way that they've sort of coalesced. But I just love Anthony Edwards because he wants to win, and that's the main thing. And so it's all about winning for him. And watching him at practice, watching him working out for the game, like, this kid wants to be great. And if you're a Timberwolves fan, you love him for that.
What's the Towns development been like? You know, you've seen it as close as anyone. I think he comes into the league. Remember, there was the GM survey where it was like, it went from Anthony Davis to 51% of the GMs, or whatever the number was, would start their franchise with Karl Anthony Towns. So then it's like, wait, is he this guy? And then it doesn't look like he's that guy. And then it turns into all sorts of criticism. And yet he still is one of the most skilled big men we've ever seen. But it didn't necessarily, you know, it was a lot of losses too. So I don't know what's fair about what I think nationally we would say about Towns.
I think he gets a lot of criticism. Some of it is fair. But I think for the most part, Carl is up there with Embiid and Jokic in terms of the talent level. The three-point shooting is there. The low post game is there. Defensively, he's been criticized. But I would say that no one's been through more than Carl Anthony Towns. I mean, Nikola Jokic has had the same coaching staff, or at least Mike Malone has been there the entire time. When you think of Joel Embiid, I mean, he had Brett Brown the entire time, and then he gets Doc Rivers, another great coach who's going to be a Hall of Fame coach. So the stability that Embiid and Jokic have had, and even Rudy Gobert, I mean, Rudy Gobert's had Quinn Snyder the entire time and had a system in place that really caters to what Rudy Gobert does. So when you talk about, Ryan, the top centers in the league, no one's been through more than Carl Anthony Towns. When Carl's drafted, Flip Saunders passes away. Sam Mitchell takes over. Tom Thibodeau comes in. The dust up between Jimmy Butler and Carl Anthony Towns happens. Then COVID hits. Ryan Saunders is the coach, and COVID hits, and Carl loses his mother. And so now, finally, he's got some stability. First time in 7 years in the NBA, he's finally in his teammates around him and a coaching staff that supports him. And I think Chris Finch is the perfect coach right now. And, you know, listening to Carl postgame, like sometimes he says some stuff that you kind of like say, wow, like did he really just say that? But what I love about Carl, and I've talked to him a bunch, and I love Carl Anthony Towns because he wants to win first. He wants to be great second. And then he doesn't really have, like, if you listen to him in his postgame pressers, like, he wants to win. He doesn't care about the statistics. He doesn't care about him shooting. He's willing to defer. He said it last night postgame after the Portland game when Ant was going off. He didn't want to mess things up by taking shots sort of like, you know, Chris Finch would say in a record scratch kind of way. And so Carl doesn't want it. So he was totally deferring. And when his number's called, he's willing to take it. But I think Carl's a lot tougher than people think. I think Carl has not had the kind of stability that all these other players have had. And I think now that Chris Finch is here, I think you're going to see the best of Carl Anthony Towns.
All right. So you mentioned D'Angelo Russell and the Pat Bev part of it, which was terrific. It's like, by the way, have I noticed Pat Beverly on the bench? It's impossible during any broadcast to not notice that he's over there. I'll be honest. D'Angelo Russell at times has been one of my least favorite players to watch play basketball. I know how incredibly talented he is, the shot making, the vision. I mean, he had a couple passes late last night where I was like, oh my God, like that's what I loved about him in college is some of the passing. But then over the course of it, like I'll never forget watching a Nets game where they kept him on the bench during overtime because they were just like, Kenny Atkinson was like, I have a better chance at this. I think last year at times with your team, it was ugly. I think you guys were fair on the broadcast about it, where he'll float defensively, where you're just like, I have no idea what you're doing and how you could lose the assignment here. But it is tightened up. And I would say you're more complimentary of it. And it's made me because you've been more complimentary as opposed to, you know, at the times where you have to be fair, you have to be critical, but these are your home guys. You know, you're not going to get on them the same way some guy in a podcast is. I've sensed a pivot both in his game and the way that you talk about him. So what have you noticed with D'Angelo?
Well, I don't know how much you've heard D'Angelo talk the game. I don't know if you've heard him interviewed as much. But he is really high functioning guy, man. His basketball IQ is off the charts, and he's great to talk the game with. So you have that. So you know that his basketball IQ is high, and so he knows what the right thing is to do. And now it's just a willingness to be able to get it done. And so that's where I say, you know, Patrick Beverly. I'm going to sit down with Patrick Beverly here coming up, and we're going to do a video room chat. And, you know, he's been a culture changer. You know, he was that way in Houston. I talked to Mikhail about when Pat Bev first came, because Mac was the coach, Finch was on the bench. What Pat Bev did to Houston to change the culture there. And then when he did with the Clippers as well, in terms of bringing toughness. So when Pat Bev comes in and he holds people accountable, and now all of a sudden, D'Angelo Russell is leading our team in defensive net rating. So like in defensive
rating, I know.
So he's leading us in defensive rating. He's leading us in net rating. So offensively, he's gotten the last month for D'Lo, the lids come off the basket. The passing thing has been unlocked. And defensively, one of the things that he's doing, Ryan, which I think is important, is that he's, you know, Pat Bev takes the tough point guard matchup, whether it's Mike Conley, whether it's John Morant, whether it's Chris Paul, it's going to be Patrick Beverly on that player. And then we've got the defensive versatility to put a Jaden McDaniels on that player too. So D'Lo typically is guarding somebody that's 3 and D, that's spotted up in the corners. So in this concept that Chris Finch runs now, like last year with Ryan Saunders and David Vanderpool, the Wolves would deploy a drop coverage concept, which you're trying to guard the pick and roll with two players. And the other three take away the three-point shot. So you want to guard the ball screen actions with two guys. You don't want to get help and start getting into rotation. Well, Chris Finch completely scrapped that, and he got talent up at the point of attack. And so now we are in rotation. We are flying around, and it really requires that the low man be communicative. So because the tone that Pat Bev set, everybody's accountable. D'Angelo Russell is one of the best communicators. Like, he's out there. You can hear him on the basket mics talking the game, talking about coverages. I'm the low man. Hey, you got to get here. Carl, get over there. Like, he's really – and communication is, for a coach, communication is probably one of the most important things. You hear Jeff Van Gundy talk about this all the time when guys are running out to call the ball screen. Early, loud, and continuous, right? You want players talking early, loud, and continuous. Well, that's D'Lo. And so when it comes to being a low man, one of the things you got to do is when Towns is up redirecting the ball handler and the roller's rolling, if you're the low man on the backside, you've got to come and pick up that roller. And a lot of times those people are a lot bigger than D'Angelo Russell. And he's been able to do that. And then he's also been willing to take charges, which we've never really seen before from him. And the other thing that defense requires in the NBA is extra efforts. You need multiple efforts within a possession. And so D'Angelo Russell, he wouldn't always be willing to go close out, Ryan, on a guy that was open. Like in a rotation situation, D'Lo wasn't always willing to sprint out there. He is now. He's been doing it consistently all season long. And you've got to give the flowers, man, when they are doing. D'Angelo Russell deserves a lot of credit for completely changing his philosophy in the defensive end.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's younger guys in this team. I mean, even Anthony Edwards, he had CJ in the fourth quarter who didn't really do much, you know, in a tight game. He didn't really even get, I think he got two shots off, I think three on the log chart. But I remember one play where McCollum's going through to the other side of the paint and Ant's following him, and then Ant sees Covington driving. And I don't know if that was, I think that was just a straight up freelance instinct move on him, because it wouldn't have made any sense that that was some rule, and he just stayed. He was like, it's late enough, the way he's driving, you know what, I'm here. And I was like, you know, maybe a special passer burns you on that, but he does not expecting Covington to do it. And there's just little instinctual stuff that makes way more sense now defensively, where I felt like there were so many times last year where even if you were close in the game, I'm like, they're going to fall apart. They're going to fall apart again. And they were just kind of easy to pick apart. But I like this team. I do. I mean, you're 8-3 now in the last 11. Number one, I think, offensive rating since January 3rd going into last night. Net rating was like fourth. And what I do like is, like, even Jaden, who struggled, and Vanderbilt, who you have to watch the Timberwolves enough to appreciate what Vanderbilt brings, because he's just kind of that in-between glue guy. I like that you have a lot of people, even Towns, even Nas, like, there's just a lot of players on the team that are comfortable with the ball in their hands. Not that you're going to run ISO for eight different guys, but it's a rotation that is now, we know exactly what the rotation is, which wasn't always the case. And everybody seems comfortable with the basketball. I'm not picking them necessarily in a first round upset win, but it finally feels like it's heading in the right direction in Minnesota, is what I watch.
And that's 100% true. You know, we don't say Gerson Rosas' name very much, but he deserves a lot of credit for putting a lot of these guys in, and mainly, you know, bringing in Chris Finch. You know, I think that I'm a little surprised that he didn't bring Finchie in faster, you know, like right away. I understand why Gerson hired Ryan Saunders. When Tibbs was let go and Ryan was the interim, Ryan did a great job, and Ryan's a great kid who's worked super hard. Everything he's gotten because he's worked for it. Obviously, his dad had a part to play, but I talked to Taj Gibson, and I talked to Luol Deng, and I talked to Derrick Rose during Ryan's interim part, and they all said Ryan deserved a shot to be the head coach. So I get why Gerson hired Ryan, and then Towns was really close to him, and Ryan deserved a shot. The COVID part of it was tough, and then the injuries that Ryan had to endure as the coach, he just couldn't sustain it. But bringing in Chris Finch, man, like I'm thinking that he's one of my favorite coaches that I've ever been around. and that I've seen in the league, the way he communicates, I think he's got a lot of sustainability in his ability to hang. And it took him a long time to get here. Like when you hear his story, Ryan, like, you know, playing over in England and then becoming a head coach right away. He actually went and was a G League coach for the Rio Grande Valley Vipers. Talks about how that's the most important coaching experience he had. Was an assistant and moved around. You know, him and Nick Nurse are like this. He's so close to all these different guys. And when you talk the game with him, man, you just realize, boy, we got somebody really special. But then, you know, the stuff that Gerson did to bring in, you know, to see the value in a Jared Vanderbilt. I mean, like, think about what Vanderbilt was in Denver. He never really played at Kentucky. He only played a handful of games in college. He was a McDonald's All-American, so it wasn't like he wasn't an unknown. You know, Gerson brought in Pat Beverly. Gerson was the one that who picked up Naz Reid as an undrafted rookie, brought him in out of LSU. He's the one that drafted Jalen Noel in the second round. So we haven't given Gerson enough credit for the things that he's done right, I think. And there's been a lot to like about this roster, and I think you're right. It's been Finch now sort of unlocking all the talents and seeing the value in guys. That's the key to coaching, right? Is to get value in them and then nurture it and grow it. And it's been so fun to watch.
It really is. And I'm telling you, like, the ant part of it too is just a reminder of the fourth quarter. Like, it was just a moment. I watched the fourth quarter again this morning because I wanted to be locked in for the interview. And I just, I'm just sitting there going, this is, it feels like, look, Towns talent, Russell talent, even go back to Wiggins thing. But like with Edwards, man, this might be another level. I want to go back in time to a high school Jim Peterson. Winning, yeah. How many state titles did you have?
Oh, two? We didn't win any.
You didn't win any? You get to the finals?
We went to the state tournament all 3 years. We lost in the final sophomore year, and then we took fourth place and third place. Like, it's one of the biggest things I regret about not winning a state title. The only championships I've won, Ryan, is when I was an assistant coach for the Minnesota Lynx. I got to go to the White House three times and shake President Obama's hand. So I went. It took me getting to be an NBA, WNBA assistant coach and coaching Maya Moore for me to win a championship.
Maya is one of the most impressive people I've ever spent time with. She used to come to ESPN every now and then to do, you know, some sort of thing. And if you just got, like, I remember being in the cafeteria talking to her about basketball and stuff. And she was like serious and she was cool, but she was also like no bullshit either. Yeah. You know, like, and it was like, man, I was like, she is an athlete. She's killer. Absolutely. How do you describe, like, the difference between being a WNBA coach and having a life in the NBA? Again, beyond the obvious, like, what are some of the things that jumped out to you? Be like, oh, you know what? This is what's different, or maybe even surprising.
These women, they play year round. So they make their name in the WNBA. You know, so Maya Moore, you know, she's at UConn, obviously a big name. She gets drafted number one by the Minnesota Lynx. We win a championship her first year. She comes in 2011, we win a championship. And so now she's a superstar. And so all these teams want her. So then, she, you know, now you're going to go over to Europe. So you make 120, 30 grand in the WNBA, but then you go over to Russia and China and the French league is good. Israel is good. The Czech Republic, like Turkey, they would be paying the superstars like Sylvia Fowles and Diana Taurasi and Sue Bird and Maya Moore and Simone Augustus. Like they're paying those gals. Like, Taurasi's making $1 million over in the Russian pro league. So they make their name, the WNBA, they've got to play all summer long for 120,000, but then they go make $1 million over there. And so then they play year round. And so, I mean, I've just never seen anything like it. I coached in the WNBA for 8 years, and I would see these players, and we would play until October to the finals, right? We went to the finals five times. And so we're playing all the way to October, and they literally finish playing in the finals and get on a plane to go to Russia or China or the Czech Republic to start their European league. And then they play all winter long. And then when spring comes, they've got to come back and do it again. And they just do this whole cycle. I have so much respect for women players and what they've done in the WNBA. Like, you have no idea how committed they are and how great they are. So when you see them up close, man, it's something else, how talented these players were. And I was lucky to be around I mean, we probably are going to have four Hall of Fame players, Lindsey Whalen, Simone Augustus, Maya Moore, Sylvia Fowles, Rebecca Brunson should be. But Cheryl Reeve is going to be in the Hall of Fame too. She's going to be the USA basketball coach now. It's one of the greatest groups of people I've ever been around to see it up close. And I can't imagine NBA players playing year round, Ryan. Like the toughness that these women show is pretty incredible.
Year round, we're lucky to get a year. we're lucky to get a season at this point, which is another topic. All right, so let's go back to you. So high school, big recruit, 6'10", the stats. You commit to Duke, and then what happened?
Man, I was obviously a big Gopher fan, like growing up. I was Michael Thompson. I wore number 43 in the NBA because of Michael Thompson. So Michael was my guy, still is. He's like a big brother to me. And Kevin McHale, you know, huge fan, Flip Saunders. But when I saw in 78, when I was a sophomore, Duke played Kentucky in the NCAA finals. Remember Jack Givens went off in the game, and it was Mike Jaminski, Jim Sponarkle, and Gene Banks. And for some reason, I just kind of fell in love with Duke University. I don't know why I did, but I just did. And then when I was being recruited, my mom wanted me to go to Iowa to play for Lute Olson, because he was dreamy to her. Like, she really fell in love with Lute, because Lute had the hair, you know, he was great. Lute was awesome. My dad wanted me to stay home. And then I was recruited by Lefter Gazelle at Maryland, and I could have been a Terrapin. I was recruited by Larry Brown at UCLA. I could have really gone anywhere I wanted, but for some reason, I just fell in love with Duke. And so Bill Foster was the one who recruited me to go to Duke University. So I fell in love with Bill Foster. And, you know, Mike Jaminski and Kenny Dennard showed me around when I was on my visit. And I actually took two visits. I went back again to visit a second time. And the spring quarter of my senior year in high school, Bill Foster leaves and goes to South Carolina. And this guy named Krzyzewski comes in. And I had no idea who he was. Well, the only thing I knew was that he was a Bobby Knight disciple from West Point. And that's the only thing I knew about Coach K. And so he decides, I'm leaving for the McDonald's All-American game the next morning. This is in April or whatever, and the game's in Oakland. So I'm leaving the next morning with my high school basketball coach, and we're going to fly to Oakland. But I meet Coach K at a place called the Thunderbird Hotel. It's where the Mall of America is now, but the Thunderbird Hotel is gone. I drive by myself to the Thunderbird Hotel and go up to Coach K's room at the Thunderbird Hotel. Can you imagine that happening today? I mean, can you imagine a kid going by himself to go meet a college basketball coach without, you know, a parent even? And so I broke up with Coach K at the Thunderbird Hotel. I told him I committed to Duke. I wanted to play for Duke. I signed a letter of intent. And I had to tell Coach K no. And it's probably one of the only regrets I have in basketball. Things worked out okay for me, but I always kind of wondered what would have happened had I gone to Duke.
That's crazy. That's and just to be like, hey, hold on, before I make the flight, I got to tell this new guy from West Point that I'm not going down to Durham.
It literally had to be one of the first things Coach K did when he got to Duke, was like to come and try to keep the recruits that they had. And so I don't know. The funny thing is, I've never seen him again to be able to talk about it. It was a long time ago. That's how long Coach K's been at Duke, by the way. Since 1980, when I was in high school. That's crazy.
I know. I bet he remembers. I bet he remembers, because it was like one of the first things he had to do. He's like, we just lost that 6'10 kid to Minnesota. All right. Give me you end up with the Rockets for a bunch of years. You're on that 86 Rockets team that beats the Lakers, that nobody thinks is going to beat the Lakers then. And, you know, it's Twin Towers. You were called the Ivory Tower. What's your best 86 finals story from that Celtics matchup?
You know, the thing about it is that back in those days, there wasn't the camaraderie that there is now. And so there was a lot of disdain. I mean, there was like, if you weren't wearing our colors, we didn't like you. So there was none of this like fraternizing going on. But I knew McHale, so we would chat a little bit before the games. But, you know, Danny Ainge was like a big time competitor, you know, like those games were competitive. And McHale and I got into some dust ups. Because it's kind of like big brother, little brother, you know, kind of thing. So we would get us some dust ups during the season. during the regular season. So now when we get to the finals, I had had all this history with all of them. And my rookie year, one of the first exhibition games I played in the NBA was against the Celtics up in Worcester, Mass. We played up in Worcester. And I'm in the game. Ralph Sampson, Hakeem Olajuwon, of course, are on the team. And we're playing up in Worcester. And I get in the game, and Cedric Maxwell and Danny Ainge are at the end of the bench. And Max goes, "Peterson, who's Peterson? Like, somebody get me a program." Like, he's literally saying that to me as I'm trying to guard somebody on the court. I forget who I was trying to guard. But at Max and Ainge, and these guys are giving me a hard time. And so it was pretty funny. And Max and I are really good friends because we played together in Houston. And so I see Max all the time now at Celtics games. We crack up all the time. Max is hilarious. But this is only a year later. So like we make the finals my second year in the NBA. When Elijah and I came in 1984, we made the playoffs in year one. We lost to Utah. But then we go to the finals in the second year. It's Samson's third year. It's Roddy McRae's third year. We're playing in the finals, and it's heated. And there was a picture that was in Sports Illustrated of me trying to block Danny Ainge's shot, but I'm just literally clubbing him in the face. Like, it's just like, I'm just like totally like clubbing in the face. And I knock him to the ground, and he grabs up, and we almost got into a little dust up fight in that. And so he goes behind the stanchion. You know how McHale would always grab the towel, McHale that's behind the stanchion, he'd always wipe his face. Well, Ainge went to go do that. And I wanted to go wipe my hands off. So I was going to grab the towel from Danny after he used it. And he took it and he threw it on the floor. And then I grabbed the towel and he grabbed it out of my hands. And so then I grabbed it back from him. And then he grabbed it back from me. And then he threw it at me and I threw it at him. And Earl Strom comes in and he goes, "Hey, guys. He goes, "Come on, man." He goes, "In 100 years, no one's going to remember any of this. So come on, let's go." And so it was like this whole, literally Danny Ainge and I are throwing a towel back and forth at each other during an NBA Finals game. It was hilarious.
That just warmed Ainge up for when it was going to happen to him as a coach, right?
Yeah, when Robert Horry wrapped one around his face.
Yeah, that was weird because you could see how heated Ainge was. Like, I can't believe a player just did this to me. But now I kind of have to just sit here and take it and show as if I'm composed, even though I don't want to be composed right now. Do you got any Barkley stuff? How brutal was it? Did you ever get stuck guarding Barkley, or were they like, "No, we're not gonna do that to you"?
Well, no, I mean, like, he was a power forward. I was a power forward. He was, for me, when people ask me who the hardest people I ever had to guard was, I always say it was Charles Barkley, because he, you know, before the 3-point shot became what it is. I mean, Charles could shoot it. So if you had to get out there and guard him, if you didn't take it away, he would shoot the three in your face, or he would shoot the long two anyway. If you pressed up on him, he was going to drive by you. If you didn't, he would shoot it. In the post, he was so big and strong, like, you couldn't guard him in the post. He had such a low center of gravity. So for me, Charles Barkley was the hardest guy to guard. And then the other one that I always say is Tom Chambers. Like, people forget about what a great player Tom Chambers is. He should be in the Hall of Fame in my book, man. That guy scored a lot of points and he was super talented. But Tom Chambers was the same way. Like, if you didn't get out there and guard him, he would shoot three. If you pressed up on him, he could drive by you. And then, oh, by the way, he could elevate and dunk it on your head. So, I didn't mind guarding Karl Malone. I didn't mind guarding Kevin McHale. For some reason, those matchups didn't bother me. It was those guys that could shoot from the perimeter, put it on the deck, and drive were the ones that bothered me.
Yeah, the early. I mean, it's weird to think of Barkley as a stretch four, but Chambers kind of was.
For sure. Know,
if you think about stretch four, because Barkley just felt like there was more to it than just say stretch four. But Chambers is. You're right. I mean, look, Chambers was. Peak Chambers was insane, but he was stuck back then at a time where we just weren't watching it enough. You know what I mean? Because it goes back to some of those Phoenix years where, you know, they just weren't on the radar as much, especially with the way television worked. Speaking of, I hope you have a moment as we finish up here just to think, like, hey, you're from Minnesota, you're born there, high school, end up a Gopher. you know, you get drafted in the NBA, but you join this franchise again in 1998 as a broadcaster. You've done the TV thing for 20 years, the Lynx championships. I'm sure you've had this moment before. People close to you tell you this, but to have that kind of connection to one area geographically and to have the accomplishments that you've had and still be a part of it, I hope you realize how cool that must be, because most people don't get that chance. So I'm happy for you, man.
I feel really blessed. And, you know, Glenn Taylor's been really good to me in this organization. Ethan Kasson, the president of the team. There's been a lot of people that have helped me about my relationship with Fox Sports North. And, you know, I just being an analyst in this league, it's such a brotherhood. You know, there's so many great analysts in this league, and it's just so fun to be a part of it. And I feel really blessed, Ryan. And I really appreciate you having me on your show. I've admired your work for a long time, and you've hit me up a few times on asked me to be a part of your show. So I'm really grateful to be here.
All right. Well, hey, enjoy the rest of the season. And hopefully we're talking playoffs. All right.
I love it. Let's do it.
This episode is brought to you by Arby's, the perfect sandwich. Let me think. Buffalo chicken sandwich is done right. Can change your life. I've never been the same in the best way possible when I experienced my first one. Also loving to travel, I've had gyros, also known as gyros. I think if you go to Arby's and you order a gyro, they're not going to judge you. And that's what I like about them. Nice chicken, perfectly sauced, butter lettuce, good body. You know what I'm talking about. And that's what Arby's has. They have more than you may even realize. Get out there and explore. Well, now is the chance to try Arby's and find your favorite sandwich. With a wide range of options, see for yourself that Arby's sells more than roast beef. Plus, for a limited time, Arby's Rewards members get one free sandwich with purchase every week in April online only. Simply join Arby's Rewards and order ahead today. Order on the app or Arby's.com.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. When I went on my last holiday to Cape Town, it was amazing. My friends were there, the weather was phenomenal, and most importantly, the food was fantastic. But one thing I struggled with was finding the right places to stay. You know, all I want is a great bed, a fantastic shower, and breakfast that doesn't end at 8 a.m. I'm on holiday, I'm still sleeping. I also like ease, and the Hotels.com app easily helps me to find a perfect hotel for every trip. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly getaway or a relaxing spa weekend, on the Hotels.com app, you can compare up to 5 hotels side by side. Now, why would you want to do that? So you can see prices, amenities, and star ratings. And best of all, you don't have to switch back and forth between options. See? Ease. So, start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app today.
You want details? Bye. I drive a Ferrari 355 Cabriolet. What's up? I have a ridiculous house in the South Fork. I have every toy you can possibly imagine. And best of all, kids, I am liquid. So, now you know what's possible. Let me tell you what's required.
Life advice. Life advice RR. At gmail.com. This one is serious. This is serious. I love this one. So we're just going to get to it. I don't want to waste any time. All right. Everybody ready?
Yeah. Okay. Kyle Sepia tone love today.
What kind of filter we got? I had the email up. So what are you? Talk to me, Kyle. What are you kind of dusky right now? What's going on with this filter?
No, just been watching 1883. I'm into it. So here we are.
Oh, all right. All right. Some of the women out there on Instagram posted some of these filters. You're like, you know, you're just making your skin look super old, right? Like it just, this doesn't look good. Just old. Hey, old skin. All right, here we go. All right, back to the email because this is serious. This is serious. All right, here we go. 62240, recently taken a CrossFit. So my most recent benchmark is a 285 clean and jerk. Avid basketball fan, frequently play pickup. This is relevant to my situation, as you'll see in a minute. Okay, all right. Squat 480, bench 350. All right, we're dealing with a serious guy here. Okay, he said he's changing some details so that we can read it full through. Thank you for doing that ahead
unabridged
of time.
Nice.
Right, here we go. For some background, I'm a married guy, mid-30s, no kids. I have one sister who's about 8 years younger than me. My wife and I live in Illinois, and my sister and mother live on the East Coast. About 3 years ago, my sister, let's start calling her Charlotte, started dating this guy, Andrew. I assume he changed these, right?
Yeah. If he said he did, then he did. And if not,
yeah, we're good.
They're in parentheses. All right. Can I keep? I know. I'm just double checking. Sometimes I'll change the change thing, and I didn't hear because it just it comes up too often. All right. So his sister Charlotte started dating this guy Andrew, and they are now engaged. He seems nice enough and is a reasonably successful guy. Works in insurance, dabbles in real estate as well. He's 5 years younger than me. Went to a good school, and I was surprised to learn he played D1 hoops. I won't say the school, but it's a notable program with some lower-seeded NCAA tournaments in the last 10 years.
Nice.
Okay. Like any other sports nerd, I went and looked it up, see what I could find of his stats, and he was pretty decent. Played decent minutes, though he was not a consistent starter. Being they live on the East Coast and we're here in the Midwest, my wife and I obviously haven't spent a time with them, especially with the pandemic. We decided this year to have them out for the holidays, and they stayed at our place for 5 nights over Christmas. While I was excited to talk sports with my sister's fiance, I mean, can you imagine how fired up the emailer is that this guy, right? So, so while I was excited to talk sports with my sister's fiance, the situation got weird quickly. God, I love this fucking email so much. One night at dinner, I was asking Andrew about playing college ball, and he was a bit evasive about answering basic questions. I had a million curiosities about travel for college athletes, balancing school and play, and wanting to know all about playing the big dance. I'm going to lose it. Sorry. Like any normal sports fan who's played a little bit, I played some high school. Oh, no. Our guy played high school and some JUCO. So, look, if you're playing junior college basketball, like, you're still ahead of, like, 98, 99% of everybody at some fucking pickup game, all right? So, like, you, the emailer here, like, you know, you're probably pretty good. You played a little. All right? I was excited to talk to an actual athlete or former athlete. At the time, I thought he probably gets these questions from people all the time when they find out where he went to school and that he played basketball. My wife agreed with me that evening when we spoke about it that I might have just come across as a little overzealous, when in my mind, I was just generally curious about the guy. Fast forward a couple days. I get up in the morning to go to the gym to meet up with a friend of mine and play some pickup. There's usually a good-sized group of guys. I can't read this email.
I'm just trying to like guess where this is possibly going. I have no idea.
Oh, because I knew when I read it the first time, I knew exactly where it was going. And I just love it so much. Because it happened to me too, by the way. All right, so here we go. Fast forward a couple of days. I get up in the morning. Usually a good sized group of guys over there holiday week, so we figured it was a good time to go. I casually ask Andrew if he wants to tag along and play some pickup. He objected at first, saying he didn't have his gear with him. But seeing as he wears basketball shoes daily anyway, I offered him some of my spare clothes to play in and assured him these games are going to be very low key compared to wherever he plays back home. Charlotte and my wife both encouraged him, and ultimately he agreed to come along.
Oh, you cornered him. Cornered him into going.
I haven't laughed this hard in such a long time, and it's not that funny. I don't know why I can't contain myself here. I need to tighten it up. After about 15 minutes at the gym, I came to the realization there's no fucking way this guy played college basketball. He had no feel for the game. He could not execute a pick and roll in either capacity. After a couple really ugly possessions of bringing the ball up, he suggested someone else do it. Then he kind of stayed out of the way as much as possible. He passed out of open looks. He got absolutely bodied inside. Defensively, he was a turnstile. We have had a couple D1 guys and a former cup of coffee pros come through the gym before, and they're absolutely dominant. I would think so. This is a suburban gym. There's usually at least one dude playing in Fila's. The level of play is not impressive, but it's decent. Suffice to say, I was absolutely embarrassed by what went down. Can you imagine what was going on in this guy's head, the fiance's head, on the drive to this pickup game? Can you imagine the internal fucking carousel of thoughts?
It's like the guy going to the Bills game. It's like, oh no.
Yeah, but this is worse, because you've told everybody you played D1 at a decent school that made a tournament run. Your stats are there. And perhaps, let's get to the full conundrum here. So I'm almost certainly, okay, wait a minute. Suffice to say, I was absolutely embarrassed by what went down. So we awkwardly drive home without a lot of talking. And the two of them left a day or so later. We never talked about it. So naturally, I had to dig into this guy's college career a bit more. What I found out is that another guy with the same name went to the same school around the same time. I found a team photo, and the dude in the photo, not the same dude. So I'm almost certain now that Andrew is pathologically lying to everyone he knows and saying that he played college basketball, because if they do a cursory Google search, it appears to be true. The question this, of course, raises, other than why the fuck would you do that, is what else is he lying about? I brought it up to my mom. Unfortunately, Dad is no longer with us. Sorry. She seems to think it's not that big of a deal and has asked me to just let it go and not tell my sister. My wife thinks it's fucked up, but I don't think she sees the lie on being the same level as I do. So let me rephrase that. My wife thinks it's fucked up, but I don't think she sees it, sees the lie as the same level that I do. I try to explain this like saying you were a guitar player in some band with two hits 20 years ago, but she doesn't see it the same way. I actually think it's still way worse than that. I don't know. She also thinks I should lay out and not mess with my sister's relationship. So what do you guys think? Do I need to tell my sister? Should I confront the guy and tell him he needs to tell her, or I will, or do I just chalk this up as harmless and let it go? It seems like a pretty erroneous red flag that someone would live their lives with such a huge lie as part of it. But my social circle doesn't seem to view it that way, likely because they're not huge sports fans. Hoping you guys have a similar mindset to mine and can provide some insight. Well, obviously, at first, I was like, well, what if he listens to the podcast? But clearly, this guy probably isn't that into hoops other than lying about it. So maybe he doesn't listen to this podcast and doesn't know. I think it's a huge problem. I think it says a lot about a person. It happened to me. We kind of like, there was a guy sort of staying with us, not really staying with us. He said he played college basketball, was also going to play college football. He was supposed to play college football at a Power Five. And then he said he played at this other school that actually made tournament runs. It's a really good basketball school. And he wasn't big. You know, he was smaller than I was. And I was, I don't know, 26, 27, something like that. So I was kind of like, wow, God, this guy must just be like one of those absolutely Jerry McNamara type of guys, right? Just absolutely lights it up, whatever. Small white guy, just can't miss, you know, tough as nails. But I was like, it still doesn't make any sense. So I called the school. Like, me and my buddy, I think we're sitting around. And we were just like, let's just fucking call and see if this guy's lying. And I called the school and I was like, hey, do you know this name? And the guy's like, never heard of him. And I was like, is there a chance maybe he got there before you or whatever? He's like, hey, dude, I've traveled with the team for 13 years. I have no idea who it is you're talking about. And I was like, okay. And then I was like, hey, do you want to play one-on-one? And my other roommate was like, are you going to play him? I was like, yeah, I want to play him. I want to see what happens. And he was like, how serious are you going to take it? I was like, I'm going to take it the most serious of anything's ever taken. And he was like, all right. He goes, I'm not going to watch because if it's bad, it's going to be so bad and you're going to be awful to deal with in that game. And I was like, all right, whatever. And I killed him. I mean, killed him. It was awful. It was embarrassing. Yes, I took it way too seriously. But if he was any good, I mean, he's got to beat me. He's going to make every shot. He's going to be, I can't stay in front of him, all that shit. Anyway, I think it was like 11-1 or something terrible. And then we came back in and the other roommate's like, how'd it go? And I was like, oh, you know. And I was almost embarrassed for the kid, even though he was lying to us about the whole thing. And he lied about a million other things, too. He was going to open up for like Dave Matthews or something, some fucking concert. Nice. I mean, it was like he was there was some deep dive stuff. So back to the email. The point is, I would tell the guy, I would say, hey, straight up, look, I'm the brother here. I care about my. It's very obvious you lied. So let's not fucking debate that at all. All right. Don't even let him. Well, no, you know, and I know. You didn't play college basketball. And I looked it up and it's the same name, but it's a different guy. So that's a problem, Don Draper. It's a real problem. I think it's a major red flag. I think it actually kind of sets the foundation for what you're capable of and what kind of person you are. I don't mean that the guy's like going to be a horrible lover. You know what I mean? But it's just that you're willing to do that as an adult close to 30 years old. And we can get into kind of the seeds that are planted for like how weird it can be when you do this stuff. It can be your own insecurity. It can be stuff that you went through when you were young. I don't know if you've heard this, but a lot of comedians will get up and talk about how they didn't get enough attention as kids. And they talk about therapy. It rarely happens with comedians, but a few have touched on the topic, right? So there are times where you can kind of, you can think like, I'll think about things that I feel and I'll go, oh, that's because of this, this and that. You know what I mean? So, yeah, we could be delicate about it, but fuck that. Because if it were my sister and you lied to me and the entire family and her that you were a different person and that it's not just basketball, it's that you were lying that you were a different person. Who knows? That could be something that got him the job. That could also be something that if it ever gets found out, that turns out that, you know, the place would fire you. They would fire you in a second unless you were absolutely killing it in sales and they'd probably just promote you and say, hey, weird story. That guy sucks. I think you have to say something, but I would go to him first and be like, we need to settle this away and figure it out because it's never, I know who you are, emailer, without knowing you. mentally, you are never going to let this rest, ever. You're just never going to get over it. So I would talk to him first so it leaves you the out of going behind your sister's back and potentially destroying her marriage before it even happens.
Yeah, I think I just know how I would handle it. I'm always kind of like, I'm team them. And like my sister likes girls. She's a lesbian. So we always kind of like, hey, what do you think of her? What do you think of her? Like, you know, we'd always been like, I'm sure
when you started, I had no idea where this was going. So now I'm like, oh, OK.
I'm just saying we're like pals in that. Like we're actually really good friends, but we're also like sort of like bros in that regard where it's just like, oh, what do you think of her? But I think people who are close to their siblings, regardless of whether they like the opposite sex of or whatever, I think that they're probably also like, what do you think? But I just know for me, I wouldn't even have thought about talking to the guy. I'd be like, I think this guy's a fucking liar. Have you noticed any other red flags? Like, I think that's what I would have said. And I probably would have wished afterwards that maybe I did confront the guy. But also,
so by team them, what you mean is team them, like your team, whoever you're closest with. So in this case, when you mean team them, you're team your sister.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Okay. All right. So, I think this is a little different, though, because they're engaged.
I mean, it's a little more urgent, I would say. You know, my sister's got a doctorate. She's probably going to be the breadwinner. So you don't want to tie the knot before you check all the red flags. I think it would make it even a little more urgent in my
The engagement might help you, though, because then you can be like, hey, dude, if you don't tell her before the wedding, like, I'm going to tell her because this is unacceptable. I've got two younger sisters. Like, if I ever found that out, I'd fucking lose my mind. So, because to Ryan, your point, like, okay, if he lied about this and he's been carrying this lie for however long it's been, probably years now, what else is he capable of doing? I'm not saying like he's like gonna, you know, be like a future serial killer, but like that's just not a thing a good normal person does. So I think you're right. Tell him, hey, you need to tell my sister or else like I'm going to spill the beans before the wedding because this isn't how we're living life. Because you're right, he's never gonna get over this. And I don't even think this guy can get over it, the emailer can get over it. Even if he does tell her, he's probably never going to like the guy anyway, but at least maybe he could feel a little bit better about his sister's ability to make a decision there. So I think that's what you got to do. But there's no way I'm letting this fucking slide. No way.
There's also a chance too, like as we're going through this, like, are we the psychos? But well, I'm not even going to open that one up because we're right. We're right in this. I'm not going to debate it.
That's not normal behavior.
It's not. Look, there is a transaction of a few years ago with somebody that I know. And the guy was saying a couple different things. And it was like, now we've kind of figured out more about it. You know, this is years ago. And it all related back to like this one lie that like slowly unraveled. And then it's like, oh, wait, now all of the other stuff makes sense. Because in the beginning, we thought it was this because the person was totally comfortable lying about this thing. I also really wish... Obviously, this is impossible. I would pay pay-per-view money to have had a dash cam in the car the ride to the gym. Because think about that. That'd be like you telling a bunch of people you just met that you're sick at an instrument. And they're like, come jam with us.
Yeah.
And you plug in and you're kind of like
just the acoustic guitar,
hammering that G chord and then laying out for a little bit, like just kind of look at each other, maybe a little thumb tap on the old acoustic to like a little rhythm. And you're not really playing and you're going, how long can I play this before everybody else is going? This guy doesn't actually know how to play the guitar. And he said he grew up with Big Head Todd. And it's like, no, none of this makes any fucking sense. And then you're right. Like, the ride, I don't know what I would want access to more. The ride there, probably the ride home. Because after the ride home, you're, you know, maybe a couple Gatorades going.
But you know what's so funny is that I wonder, I want to know what this guy's size was. Was he above 6 foot? I mean, he had to look like a basketball player, right? And then he also said that he was wearing like basketball sneakers around. So you would think that he like, maybe is some kind of an athlete. I don't know.
He likes the culture, man.
Yeah, maybe. But like if he was like six foot and like a little bit chubby, wouldn't you have some like reservations before then? Or would you be like, I don't know, maybe just put on some pounds? I don't know. I want to know if he looked the part of a basketball player. One basketball player.
I'm deferring to the emailer here that if the emailer is big as, you know, these are serious numbers. This guy's a decent sized guy. He's obviously really strong, too. And he played a little JUCO ball, that this guy must have passed the eye test enough to even get to this point. For the emailer to have believed the fiance's story, that I don't think he showed up looking like 40-year-old version Seth Rogen.
So what do we think? This guy probably lied like on the first date as an in to be like, hey, I was a D1 hoops player. And then that's just kind of where it grew from there.
I don't know.
And then he could never tell her the truth.
The unnecessary lie to bolster your life is just, it's makes me sick.
It's one thing to lie, like if you're like in Cabo and you're meeting people and you're never going to see them again. It's another thing to lie on the first date and then get engaged to that person.
Cabo, it's okay to lie.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can be like, yeah, I played D1 hoops, and then you all go your separate ways, and then here you go.
Yeah, Van Pelt told me back in the day those guys used to say they were refs.
What?
I was like, is that even cool? Be like, oh, did you go home with that ref? That guy was hot. Like, yeah, he's like big sky ref. I don't know. He told the story on the air. So I don't even know if how true it was. I remember one time I got accused of lying about being a baseball player because I was out with baseball players. And I was like, why? I don't need to lie about it. And first of all, I'd be exposed in 2 seconds. Like, so what are you talking about? And it was like, no. You said you were with these guys. I was like, yeah, I was there working out with them. But you made the assumption that I played. Thank you. All right. 6'5", 310. Best of all, I am liquid. Like it. I have this buddy. Let's call him James. Found this girl on Tinder. They started texting. She's 19. My buddy's 26. The only social media she has is Instagram. She gets about 20 likes per picture and posts all seem to be from the same day. Dun, dun, dun. I already know where this is. Yeah. I mean, just one day she started up Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
Check me out. This is me with a ladle. 19 years old. What 19-year-old girl only has had Instagram or only has Instagram and doesn't have other girls commenting, hyping her up? That I don't know. You guys are going to have to help me with that one. Myself and our friend group think he's getting catfished. They have planned a date 3 different times and she's canceled every time. Maybe she's busy. Maybe she's a writer. They've never talked on the phone and still have never met. Wait, they've never talked on the phone. They were going to meet up for 3 dates. Yeah, your friend's going to catch.
Yeah,
that's right. He's in denial. Yeah, he's in. Yeah, there's nothing. Do I read the rest of the email? Let's just read it. But there's nothing else. We've cracked the case. He's in denial. And when we tell him to stop entertaining this catfish, he responds, quote, I'm single, so it's someone to talk to.
Nope.
He's someone who gets very invested very fast. And I'm worried that with him still talking to her, he's going to start catching feelings and be hurt when he finally comes to his senses that nothing can ever be between them. As one of his best friends, do I still try and tell him to stop or just let him get his heart crushed, which will crush me to watch happen? Shout out, Kyle.
Make fun of him all the time. That's what I would do. All the time, make fun of him. He's going to start sending this person money. It's just happening. It's going to happen.
Yeah. Somebody's car bill just got taken care of.
Yeah. Make fun of him incessantly, all the time.
Somebody's got a new transmission.
Even if it makes you feel bad, push through. Make fun of him.
Okay. So he's clearly getting catfished. Yeah. You've never talked to the person on the phone. All right. I mean, forget FaceTime and the capabilities that we have. You've never actually talked. Canceled 3 times. Instagram posts all for the same day. I mean, I get flooded with those. There'll be like some breakout in the Emirates where all of a sudden it'd be like, hey, want a party fuck time DM. And then, you know, it'll be like you look at the picture and it's like 7 posts from the last hour. They follow me, Steve Levy, and I don't know, Mike Trudell. And you're like, okay, this seems to be a specific lane of verified sports people. And then they'll have like no one follows them or it'll be like a fake number of followers or whatever. I mean, it happens all the time. And the key is always like, you can always tell, first of all, the DM usually gives it away. That doesn't really happen a lot. Like the podcast.
Bad translate.
Well. Yeah. Yeah. Right. But the podcast isn't doing that well. That's the kind of DMs that dudes are getting. But I think you got to let him get his heart stomped here to learn a lesson because it's so obvious what's happening to him that I don't know, Kyle, what do you think?
No, I think you got to just bother about it all the time. Like, don't make it your mission in life, but just like make it a thing that you make fun of him for, I think. I mean, this shit is everywhere. How do you not know? I'm getting it. I play Words with Friends. I get like catfish attempts on Words with Friends. They play one word and then they're like, hey, how's it going? And it's like Marie 12793789. She joined.
Wait, you're talking to Marie?
I've been talking to seven versions of Marie. Yeah. Sometimes I actually do just be like, hey, what's going on? How's it? And then sometimes, yeah. Sometimes I won't answer, and then they'll just keep, like, they'll stop playing words, but then you can't play another word until, you can't type another message until another word's played. So, like, sometimes I'll get, like, 7-8 moves out of them just to keep my game scores up. But they're everywhere. How does this guy not know? I think if you're going to be that much of a blind doofus, then, yeah, like, you're going to be known in our friend group for the guy who's actively getting catfished until you stop it. And that might seem cold, that might seem whatever, but that's how I would handle this.
Did I ever tell the story of how I invented catfishing?
You did.
This is the timestamp right here. This is the Life Advice timestamp. Starts right now.
You invented catfishing.
I did. High school. yeah. People are going to think I'm a huge dick. I'm really not. So basically I forget why we did this. Like, one of our buddies was just like kind of being annoying, and we were dicking around. We were like, hey, why don't we just create a bunch of fake MySpace accounts? And we created, like, probably six of us created like six different people that were all in a friend group, and they were like from the town over from us. And we all friend requested our buddy at the same time. And like, I was a dude. One of my friends was the chick. And like, there was a couple other girls, a couple other guys. And like, we would interact with each other on MySpace. Everybody was in everybody else's top eight. And we tried to arrange a meetup, but he didn't take the bait on it. So we were the first. I think that was 2005 or 2004, probably. So I credit myself with inventing catfish.
No one had attempted prior to that, you believe?
I don't know. The show didn't come out yet. Nobody was talking about it. It's not like we weren't like inspired by, you know, Neve and that guy. I don't even know if I knew who that was yet. So we were just like, screw it, let's create some fake MySpace profiles and see what happens. And it didn't work out, but the seeds were planted.
We had Neve on the radio show. That didn't go great.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Was that the guy? That's the guy.
Yeah. Who, like, he was like the, yeah.
Hugs the people that are getting catfished.
Yeah. I remember Machine Gun Kelly was on an episode of Catfish, and he was like walking down the street yelling at the person, being like, yo, you just can't do that. That was early Machine Gun Kelly. So what happened to your friend when he found out, Cerruti?
He was pretty pissed, but we were all like, I think we were all mostly on the football team. We were playing, a couple of them weren't, but you know, mostly nice. In the same friend group. And we were just kind of bored, and we were like, he did something I forget that was like that, like, kind of pissed us off, and like, let's get him back, let's do this. And one of us came up with the idea of doing that.
So you guys created
MySpace.
You guys created like six email accounts and did the whole thing, huh?
Yep. Wow. My name was Darren Sharper. I remember I made a guy named Darren Sharper.
Hardest hitting safety in the league.
Yeah, I think that's probably why I did it. Not so great now, but yeah, it was, and he was from Cheshire. Shouts out to Cheshire, Connecticut, and. Like, he was in for a while. Like, I remember he friended her. I think there was a message or two that was exchanged. But when the meetup thing kind of was pushed, when our fake account tried to, you know, force the meetup, I think he sniffed it out and was like, fuck you guys.
How do you force? How do you start that? Like a friendly suggestion to meet up from the guys from the next town over.
So I think we had the girl first, the fake girl account.
Right.
Friended him and then started talking to him about how she knew one of his friends, and then we all friended him together and were friends with her. So it was like, oh, maybe her friend group is like friending, you know, our friend Greg, because we're interested in, you know, she's interested.
So
in
do you
him.
Think your friends moved in too fast? You think that you're where
Probably.
You messed up was,
I mean, we definitely didn't like
the
have
whole
a great
group
plan for it.
Yeah,
we thought like, we can't just have one person, so we'll have multiple people and we'll try to attack her from those angles and make her profile seem legit. And like, you know, we had different pictures and whatnot. And, you know, it wasn't all pictures from the same day, like our friend here. So we tried to make it seem legit, but it, you know, I don't know. We were amateurs.
I can't believe you just admitted that.
That's all right. We were young.
Stupid. Yeah, yeah.
16.
Wow. Man, MySpace. Pour one out.
Yeah.
Thanks to Kyle and Steve. We'll be back on Friday. Please subscribe to the Ryan Russillo Podcast, Ringer, and Spotify.